Thank you, Soren, for coming on the podcast today and taking the time. I really appreciate it. You are well known as a designer and you're working on Cash App, but most people know you for posting new ideas daily on Twitter. That's how I found you, and lots of super interesting ideas that you're posting on there with, nice and easy to look at designs and everything like that. It's one of the more interesting sort of Twitter projects I've come across. So it's great to be able to speak with you. I think one of the earliest places that we could start that might be fun is to talk about one of your first ventures into design. When you were in high school, you made a lyric video for a guy named Treg Frank and his band. And I think it took like a week's worth of work, but you only made like $25. And I think you got a t-shirt and some tickets out of it. So obviously you didn't do it for the money. I'm curious, what motivated you to do that very first project, if that was in fact the first, and sort of dip your toes into design in the first place?
It was my first job to other than mowing lawns, right? So even though I wasn't getting paid much, it was like $25 and probably a couple of weeks worth of work. And I was working a lot on it because I was learning the programs as I was going through it. I think I kind of caught this bug where I realized you could get paid to be creative and just to make things. And so I kind of kept pulling that thread. And I think because you're working with local bands, it's not super high risk work like it would be, trying to do product design for a big client. Treg was a friend, but then their drummer, Griffith, he was the person that we were chatting on Facebook, and they needed someone to do their video. And I just volunteered myself, and I didn't have any credentials or any portfolio, but I don't think they had a lot of options at the time either. And so, yeah, I started there. I really enjoyed the process of the work. And I think kind of what I did from there was I continued to take opportunities, and every opportunity was a chance to kind of build proof or a portfolio that you could charge a little bit more. So maybe that first video was $25, and then the next one was like 50, and then 100, and then kind of onward from there. But that was really how I got my start freelancing, was just saying yes, figuring stuff out, and then using my body of work that I was building up to justify kind of better or more reasonable pricing. I think also I lived with my parents because I was a high schooler, so I could get away with not having it be a full-time job, right? But yeah, that's kind of how I got my start.
Yeah, it's a great start. I think a lot of times people will sort of sign up for something and like, or people will rather, overanalyze something before they get started as to like, oh, well, what's this for? Like, what's this going to lead to? But you just can't really like connect the dots looking forward, as Steve Jobs said. And like, you gotta just sort of trust and follow your gut. And you end up volunteering for this one little design project for a band, and like now look at you. So it's a very interesting sort of journey. And I'm always curious about sort of like those first couple of steps. But I don't know what the next couple of steps were, and maybe we could talk a little bit about that. But I know by the time you were in college, you were sort of doing a lot of design work on the side. I think senior year you said like you were almost doing like a full-time job worth of it. And were you like learning design in school, or how did the track of sort of like schooling and design work in parallel for you?
Yeah. So I realized through that work that I did in high school that I was on the fence between studying music business and design. And what I ended up doing was I decided to study art with an emphasis in design, but then I also minored in business. And so I was doing a lot of studio artwork, so learning things like both typography and layout, but then also studio art classes where you're drawing a person in front of you, or doing sculpture or doing painting. So I had kind of that creative body of work that I had to do as part of my coursework. But then on the flip side, I would be in a marketing class or a macroeconomics class. And so I kind of had both ends of the spectrum there, education. And then the work, I think I started working on campus, whether it was for someone that needed a design for a dorm event, I would just do that. And then I started working on campus organizations. And then I ended up getting an opportunity from someone that I knew on campus that was at an agency. to go back into motion design, which is where I'd gotten my start back in high school. And then by the end of university, yeah, I had interned there before my senior year, and I was working, I want to say, like 20 to 30 hours a week at the agency. And then I was also doing a little freelance on top of that, and then my full course load. So I think all of those things feel very disparate and unrelated if you're looking at them in the moment and even in retrospect. But I think looking at where I landed now, there's fragments of knowledge that were pulled from all of those different lanes that have kind of converged into what I do now.
Could you sort of elaborate a little bit on like these different fragments? Because I know you've spent quite a bit of time with agencies. I mean, not so much, but at least a couple of years. You've spent some time working with startups. You studied some of this in school. You were doing some work on the side, some freelancing. You founded a company of yourself. And then those are sort of like the different types of organizations or organizational contexts under which like you've done this work. But you've also done very different types of work, you know, eventually landing more towards like the product design side of things. So I'm curious, like, however you break it up in your head, how these different categories of work or contexts of organizations that you've worked for have sort of summed up to some of the more core principles of what you think about and do with your work today.
Yeah, so I'll start with the kind of formal learnings in university and then also the different kind of segments of the professional field that I worked in. So in school, there's kind of three buckets. There's the art bucket, the business bucket, and then the freelance or design work bucket. And I think the art bucket, I did not go to a school where it was like a trade school where they teach you the tools. The expectation was you'll teach yourself the tools on the side. It was more focused on theory, learning how to think critically, learning how to evaluate work, how to provide critique, and then how to refine critique. So it's much more of a critical thinking skill set, and also gaining an understanding of historical knowledge of art history. And then on the business side, there's very basic principles that would be taught at any business program. So microeconomics, macroeconomics, statistics. But then the area of that I gravitated the most towards was marketing. So one course that was particularly memorable was this marketing course where you had to do a target market project, where you basically had to evaluate a sector and then kind of tear down a couple of different businesses and then basically size up a new business, build that business, and then write basically a proposal for the formation and the marketing of that business. I learned a lot through that. And then the third pillar is this kind of like side work. And I think part of that was honing my craft and gaining a skill set. But I think the other kind of long tail effects of that were a lot of communication basics that people might not learn until they're actually on the job or in the practice of freelancing. So learning how to negotiate with clients, learning how to set expectations, make sure invoices get paid, but then also just putting in the work. I think working while having a full course load was a lot, but I think that galvanized my work ethic and willingness to just put in the time to get stuff done. And then I think coming out of the educational environment and going to the professional workforce, I think the great thing about agencies is you get exposure to an incredibly broad range of work in an extremely compressed time scale. So you learn how to context switch and how to put together high quality work and present it in a very short amount of time, because you're just juggling multiple clients and everything's usually project or retainer based. So you just need to get stuff done quickly. And there's a very high bar for quality if you're at a good agency. And then I think on the startup side of things, I think similarly working at a fast pace, but then I think a lot of the kind of ideas of discovery, not being able to rely on a large pool of resources like you would at a large company, and being resilient and open to new things. And I think, again, it's a way to refine your craft, because you're often at a startup as a designer, the person handling the product work, the marketing work, the visual and brand identity, and then oftentimes a lot of the product thinking as well. Sometimes you'll have a product management hire, but oftentimes you are responsible for a lot of that work and you're working directly with the executives, specifically at early stage stuff. And then looking at working at a large company, I think you're able to, well, it depends on the organization, right? But working at a large company, you have a lot more resources and you're able to do work that is far more broad in impact, but the time scale is often expanded versus what you would experience at an agency, due to the fact that it's almost like a startup is a jet ski, and you can, in theory, when you're very early stage, do very sharp turns of the jet ski without upsetting the, for carrying the metaphor forward, passengers, right? So you can make really quick turns and adjustments. But if you're at a large organization with millions and millions of customers or users, it's more like an aircraft carrier. And even a fragment of a degree change in the product trajectory can pretty significantly disrupt not only people's experience when using the product, but also brand trust, brand perception. So the work is a lot more incremental and calculated. And even if you do want to make this big behavioral steer or shift, the steps and rate at which that done is often more drawn out. So that was a kind of bit of a rabbit hole of answers. But yeah, I think I learned very different things within all of these different areas of work and life, but I think you can often pull those certain principles from any one of those and apply them in other contexts.
Yeah, I think that's a super useful framework for, you know, aspiring designers, but also in general, thinking about sort of the different pros and cons of large orgs versus smaller orgs. Yeah. And what to do during school and how to spend your time and what to study. And certainly covered a lot of ground. And I think it's just a sort of fundamental way to look at each of those different sorts of, you know, contexts. So that's very useful. I'm curious, you know, currently you're working on Cash App, and previously had a stint at Square as well. I think with some sort of gap in between. But where do you consider like Cash App sort of on that spectrum? It's obviously got a huge user base, so these differences and changes that you're pushing out are going to, you know, large groups of people. But at the same time, it's sort of like a startup-y type of culture, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think it's a large organization with a lot of users, and so maintaining customer trust and kind of preserving the experience is very important. I work on the investing product, so there's a lot of trust there specifically. But yeah, I think the designers there are amazing. And a lot of the designers that have been there in the past are very inspirational as well. When I was at Square, Cash App was kind of the cool kid on the block, which I didn't realize that on the block was a pun until I said that, because they're all under that parent company. But yeah, I think it's a really special place. And yeah, I think that's about it.
So obviously you've got a full-time job there, but also you've become well-known on Twitter and elsewhere for these daily designs. So it would be remiss not to dig into those a little bit. I think the best place to start would be to talk about just how you are so prolific in putting these things out every day. Like, it strikes me that, like, you know, if you are working on something that's sort of like blocking and tackling or just pure execution oriented, then doing it on a daily cadence, I mean, doing anything on a daily cadence is quite difficult, but the less creative it has to be, I think, the more reasonable it seems to keep that cadence. But this is sort of like max creativity where, you know, granted, you're not doing everything like absolutely from scratch, but you're coming up with novel and intriguing, sometimes, you know, more satirical, sometimes more useful features for these well-known apps, and you're doing it every day. So is there any sort of like process that you have or tricks towards sort of coming up with these things every day?
Yeah. So I think it's interesting because the difficulty, I would say, comes in waves. So I think early on, it was really hard because I had no foundation to start with. So when I started doing this, it was just a blank Figma file and I started pulling stuff in. And then I think now I have a 6-month repository of past work to reference, right? And you can actually take existing work and then iterate or riff on it without as much effort as the initial creation. So I think it was really hard early on. It's gotten easier, but then there are definitely moments where I feel almost like out of gas. And I think full credit to, it's funny, I almost compare myself to like a design version of ChatGPT, because my DMs, it's often just strangers unsolicited with no context sending me feature requests. And some of those are thought-provoking. Some of them I have already done, or some of them I've done a permutation of. But I think sometimes there's stuff that's crowdsourced that I'll take a suggestion and then usually riff on it a little bit. And then I also have a small group of friends that I'll just be texting back and forth with them and we'll riff on stuff. I think there's two ways that I've dealt with creative block. One way is to just brute force it and force myself to open my computer, get into the Figma file and just start designing stuff without knowing where it's going to go. And because I know that I have to do something every day, that actually helps more often than not. And then I think the other way I deal with it is just taking a break, shutting my computer, taking a walk, or like getting dinner or whatever it might be, whatever time in the day. Sometimes the distance helps, and actually not thinking about it and thinking about other things will lead you to kind of some idea. For a while I had a backlog and then I exhausted the backlog. And so now it's like, I haven't designed tomorrow's yet as of this conversation, but I'm sure I'll figure it out. And then I think the other part of it is, I think it wouldn't be possible if I hadn't spent the last 5 or 6 years in Figma almost every day. So it's a tool that is almost second nature to me, right? So I'm able to execute very quickly because I've used the tool so much. And I have this past kind of body of work now to pull from. So yeah, it's challenging at times, but I think it's like anything, it's a muscle that you train, and the more you train the muscle, the better you're able to use it.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. And it gives me a little bit of stress to know that you don't have tomorrow's ready to go already, but I'm sure you will figure it out. Seems to have worked so far. Couple different directions I'd like to sort of go into from there, a little deeper on the process, also into Figma as a tool and maybe some other tools. But maybe we can start with sort of this library that you've talked about, or you might have another word for it, of sort of these artifacts that, you know, you've created over the last 6 months, some of which are easy to leverage or at least accelerate your process a bit. How is that like designed for someone who might not be familiar with, you know, Figma or just design work in general? You sort of have to design the library in and of itself. How have you gone about doing that?
Yeah. So to be clear, it's not like components. So there's no design system. I'm not setting up all the type styles or color styles or anything. Really what it is I think about the work almost like a body of jokes. So it's like I have specific joke formats. So there's the Uber Hotbox, right? So the template is you have the view of calling an Uber, and then you slightly subvert the feature that Uber offers, because Uber will have, you know, like Uber XL, Uber, the regular Uber, or like Uber Pool. And so just taking that moment and then slightly changing it. So Uber Hotbox being one example, or Uber Apache Helicopter, or Uber, what's the like Libra, the signs, the horoscope signs. It's like a match with the driver that has the same horoscope as you. Or you can therapist. Kind of take, yeah. Oh yeah. The Uber BetterHelp therapist option. You basically take a specific moment of interaction within the app, and then you can subvert it a bunch of different ways. Another one that is very popular is iMessage, because it's a fairly universally understood form factor and point of interaction. So you think of kind of social scenarios, whether it's, you know, someone's mad at you and they're typing something up and you're dreading the response. It's like, what if you saw how long the response was? What if you saw that they screenshotted something? What if you saw their average response time? You basically take tiny parts of the interaction and you just change them a little bit to exacerbate or change the existing emotional response. So there's a lot of anxiety within the iMessage typing bubble, right? Like, you know, someone's typing. So one very popular concept that I did was like the bubble changes size based on how long the message is. But okay, something that I haven't done that you could do is like, what if the bubble changed color based on the mood of the person, right? So it's potentially like pull the text from the message that's being drafted. And if it's angry in language, it could turn red. Or if it's like romantic, it turns pink, right? You could get a pre-read of what that is going to be. But I think what happened early on was I was trying to go too broad with trying to make kind of new things. And rather than kind of remaking an entire thing, just taking an existing thing and a specific scenario within that thing and slightly changing it is one, much easier to execute on, but then two, it's much easier for someone to quickly parse when they are going around the internet, right? It's a familiar thing, but it's a very slight tweak to it.
Yeah, I mean, the whole style has like definitely struck a chord. I think I read somewhere, I think in one of the articles that covered you or some of your writing, that you've gone from like a couple thousand followers to, you know, a few hundred or a couple hundred thousand in the last 6 months or something like that. And it's not like, you know, a lot of these like big accounts that I think of as like, okay, here's like a Twitter guy. That's like, they're like sort of doing these like, you know, AI threads or like whatever sort of algorithmic type of content. And I look at your stuff and like, yes, you have sort of a framework and a model that you just sort of talked about and I think is very interesting, but this is like really, to me, like very creative work that's like very unique. And I haven't seen anyone else do this sort of thing. And I think for good reason, because it's like very difficult, even with these sort of tricks that you've developed. Going into, you know, you talked about like moments a little bit and like discovering these moments, the moment you're booking an Uber and looking at the various options, the moment someone's texting and, you know, iMessage and you're wondering what they're going to say or whatever. So it seems like there's sort of a moment discovery aspect of what you're doing where, you know, one good moment that you discover might sort of catalyze a dozen plus great ideas that can sort of come through that. So I'm curious if you have any sort of framework for actually sort of upstream of doing what you can with each moment, discovering new moments. And maybe you could talk about like a specific example, I guess, of one that you came across and how that happened, because it seems like there would be some sort of element of randomness to it, but also sort of a way to maybe help yourself get lucky.
Yeah. Before I answer that, I wanted to say, because you said like I'm the first person or only person to do this, I think there are actually a few other really interesting people doing comparable things. Like before I ever did this, Laurent Del Rey, who's a designer at Snap, and then Jordan Singer, who's a designer at Cash App, and then at Diagram, and then both of them have been doing tangentially related stuff, not so much humor as much like serious explorations, but they've been doing some really interesting stuff for years. So worth looking at their stuff if anyone is interested. But I think to your question about like a framework for moments, I think the interesting short answer is there is no framework. I think just like living life and just doing things has been the way to make the most interesting work. So for example, we were flying back from a trip. We were in LAX and we needed to make a connection flight that was really tight, and the plane was overbooked, and we were like running to the plane because we were late, and it was very stressful. And there's a person that we were kind of running alongside through the airport to get to the flight with, and they're being somewhat aggressive, but it's fine. Like we're all stressed trying to get where we're at. And in the back of my head, I'm like, what if you had to like fight someone? And then I was like, okay, I'm going to put that in my kind of brain and sit on it. And I think it's just moments of strong emotion of any kind. You cultivate those by just living a life beyond the screen and beyond like reading articles and creating frameworks. So I think there's no like guidebook, but I think just like looking at what humans do and what causes any sort of strong emotional reaction, I guess like what you can do if you were to try to create a framework is like, what does the average person experience that they really don't like, right? Like most people don't like their landlord, or that's like a bit that has been architected into a lot of sitcom and pop culture. So like I haven't really done anything with that, but there's probably something that I could do about like Zillow or apartments.com, where it's like you get to interview the landlord or you get to meet the landlord, things like that, right? So I think almost like when you're, if you watch a comedy sketch and if you unpack kind of the jokes that they're telling, if it's not absurdist comedy, usually what they're doing is looking at broadly shared human experiences and talking about them in a somewhat humorous way. And I think similarly, the way that we interact with devices is so ingrained with our daily lives that you basically take what people are doing in their real life, and then you look at how their digital life interacts with that, and then you find a way to change it to make it either absolutely insane or, if you want to be helpful, like more useful, right? So that's a loose way to think about it. I haven't vocalized it like that before, but if I had to, I think that's kind of a way to think about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. The closest sort of comparable of something that I've tried to do was a few years ago, I was made it a point to like publish a blog post every day or every weekday for, I ended up doing it for like 6 or 7 months. And similarly to what you're saying, like if I had to sort of pick, maybe framework was like not the right word, it's not like so structured, but a few themes of like things to sort of think about and to do to sort of lend yourself towards, you know, some of these ideas coming at the velocity that's sort of like needed to be able to put this, put out the daily output, is first of all, sort of like living an interesting life in a way that was just like very helpful. I realized basically one of my favorite parts about writing every day was it actually like forced me to have a more interesting life in order to have sort of more interesting things to write about. And then secondarily, I think you've sort of mentioned like this just constant awareness that I think naturally comes from whatever your sort of life focus and priority is on, you will naturally sort of be more aware of the thing that you need to be aware of in order to do that. So in my case, it was like an idea for a blog post. You're always just like everything that sort of passes through your brain is like running through this filter subconsciously of like, could this be a blog post? I feel like, and that just sort of comes by training of getting used to having these ideas, I feel like. And in this case, it's, you know, running through the airport. Most people are thinking about their flight and you're over there thinking, hey, you know, maybe I could fight this guy. So it's kind of interesting. And then lastly, something that I hadn't thought about, but is pretty interesting and sort of similar to this awareness concept is sort of keeping tabs on your like emotional strength. And I guess maybe I've sort of done this in terms of like inspiration, if you count that as an emotion, like when you feel a strong sense of inspiration, maybe that's something. But I never thought of it in the context of like, okay, I'm really stressed right now, or I'm really angry right now, or I'm really happy right now. Maybe there's like something here. And that's sort of like an interesting thing to, I think, filter for, or just build that subconscious awareness of in general. And again, this is, you know, not just for thinking of designs or creative ideas or blog posts, but I think it's sort of generally useful principles, which is, you know, maybe not a framework, but like something along those lines. So when it comes to, you know, we've talked a bit about like sort of the ideation of these things, but when it comes to actually execution, you mentioned that like Figma has been tremendously useful and you couldn't sort of do what you're doing today without years and years of work there. But you started, you know, work in design before Figma. So I'm curious how Figma has changed like the execution of your work and just what life was like as a designer basically before and after.
Yeah. So I think Figma is an amazing tool, but all tools are simply a means to an end, right? There might be a completely different tool that everyone uses in 10 years because 10 years ago, people were designing websites in Photoshop, right? I think looking at the beginning of my career, I somehow ended up using After Effects as my first design tool, which is a motion graphics and animation tool from Adobe. And the interface is extremely complicated. I think I basically decided to start playing the game of design on hard mode. And then when I started getting into Photoshop and Illustrator, I was like, wait, these are much easier. And all of those are layer-based applications. So you create multiple different layers of content in After Effects. You can move those pieces of content around. In Photoshop, it's more about refining the visual output. And then in Illustrator, it's a vector-based program. So it's more like it in the name for illustrating things. But I used mostly Adobe tools up until 2015, maybe. And then 2015 to 2017, I was primarily using Photoshop and then Sketch to create a lot of my work. So Photoshop for more visually complex output, and then Sketch was for actually putting together website designs. And then Figma, an agency I was at, a fellow designer made me aware of it, and I just kind of started working in it and then started working in it more and more. The multiplayer aspect of it was pretty mind-blowing when it first came out. And then I think I refined my skill in that both at Square and at Cash App, and then working with startups. And I think also most of my work happens in Figma, but there are moments where you need to go into another tool in order to get a certain desired output. So for example, back in, I think, March, I did the Hinge feature to preview your date in AR. And so I needed to take a photo of my office and then grab a photo off the internet of like a 3D model of a person. And then I needed to remove the background from that 3D model and composite that on top of the chair. So there was some more intense Photoshop work happening. And then I put all of that into Figma, right? So I think because most product design stuff is constrained to one tool, and I'm very familiar with all of the keyboard shortcuts and kind of ways to quickly navigate that tool, it's become a lot more efficient. But I think it's a tool in the tool belt. And I think like I've been learning new things like Framer and Swift UI and kind of other things that will hopefully allow me to design and even prototype and develop work rather than just doing static design, right? So it's whatever you need to do to get the job done, you find the appropriate tools and use them.
Right. So I'm like somewhat familiar with Framer, but not super familiar. My understanding is it sort of helps you as a designer to just like create an, you know, actual website or whatever it might be and not need to know how to code and everything like that. Is that something that, you know, it's a little newer, I think, than Figma, more recent, at least I've heard of it within like last year or so. Is that something that you could envision having like a similar impact on the, you know, for the lives of designers basically as like Figma has had, or it's like a different thing?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think Framer has actually been around for quite a long time, but they've gone through multiple product pivots. And the idea of a very simple way to build and implement websites in production is kind of the newest permutation of their business model. And I think it's resonated extremely well with a lot of designers. And so I think it is great for more self-contained web work, but I think for end-to-end more complex product builds, it's I don't think they're intending to do that. And so it serves a different purpose, right? But I think for low code slash no code website building, it's a great tool. And I think a lot of designers are starting to build similar to Figma when they launched the Figma community. They're starting to build a series of products within that product ecosystem. So like Figma almost has their own like sub economy of people creating plugins and resources within Figma. The same thing is happening with Framer.
Right. So last question on tools. I've sort of read, I think you're mostly not using AI for anything, any like core part of your process. I'm curious, you know, obviously people are using it for a wide range of uses, but have you, you know, tried to find ways to make it useful? Are there particular reasons you've decided to stay away from it, or ways in which you could sort of foresee it becoming useful in the future?
Yeah. So I think the one thing that I do use AI for is for avatar photos, because I don't want to just grab random people's images and post them on the internet, right? So I just use a AI avatar image generator. Outside of my satirical work, I do use ChatGPT for often a first permutation or like a slight revision of content design. So when you're writing copy, taking a block of copy and compressing it into something that's more succinct and written in a specific tone, that's been helpful. Another thing I use that for is not all, so I haven't figured out how to get it to do kind of like larger kind of blocks of code. I think a lot of people use it as a code companion. I will use it as a way to debug, but I think I'm still pretty early on in my understanding of development. And so I'm also working on understanding a lot of the underlying principles and the language, because the specificity of your input impacts the output. And I think initially when I started trying to use ChatGPT with code, my language and semantic understanding of code was so rudimentary that the output often wasn't what you would want, right? So I'm kind of going back and doing a little bit more foundational establishment of knowledge before I start to use it as a tool like I would with design and copywriting.
Yeah, that makes sense. You obviously, you know, you're posting these daily designs and it's like extremely niche, right? Like there's this one type of content that people expect from you day in and day out. You're just delivering and delivering and delivering. But, you know, I noticed like you put I think it was a survey out a while ago on whether, you know, you're learning how to code. Would people be interested in sort of like you posting in public on sort of your progress along that journey? And so I guess on a specific example, I'm curious sort of how you thought about that, whether to sort of do this in public or just more privately on the side. And more broadly, I'm curious your thoughts on like maybe the trade-offs of niching, for lack of a better word, like constraining your Twitter profile, which to be fair, like it's not like you or like your full personhood or anything like that, but your Twitter profile is sort of like this very, very specific thing. And I'm curious if you sort of deal with thinking about like, hey, maybe I can like still do this stuff, but also, you know, would you want to sort of tweet about other stuff, and just sort of the pros and cons of doing this very specific type of content?
Yeah, I've thought about this a fair amount. I think the internet, not just a specific platform, but any platform on the internet, rewards specific, myopic, and almost like repetitive content. So the more you can narrow in on, you come to this place, you get this thing, the easier it is to get distribution because you're theoretically a product, right? The double-edged sword of that is if you want to do something else, people will be very confused and frustrated. I think I came to grips with the fact that people that don't know me are going to know me as this like satirical design person for at least the next season of my life. And that's okay. I think it's a way to get introductions to and to meet and to connect with people that see the humor and the value in that, but they also understand that it is indirectly signaling a deeper level of understanding and interest, right? So it's like, oh, this guy's got a good sense of humor. Oh, but he also knows how to design and has an understanding of product thinking, right? It's, you're indirectly saying a lot of things. And I think, yeah, people that follow me are expecting a certain type of thing. I think if I, you know, stop doing that at some point, like that's fine. I think for now I'm fine with kind of staying in this specific vein. And if I want to do something else at another point, that's my decision to make. And like, if the people that follow me don't like it, like that's unfortunate, but it's a free service that I'm providing. And if I want to make that change, that's up to me. But I think the alternative way for a lot of designers to kind of build up a network or meet new people, when you get to a certain level of seniority, I see kind of a couple ways. One is people post their serious work, which is high craft, high output, very visually appealing, but often there's like a lot of thinking and strategic depth behind it. I wouldn't mind doing that, but also I shouldn't be posting a lot of the stuff that I'm working on internally until it's in production. So, and then the other vein that people go down is this like thought leader category, right? Where they're kind of giving their opinions to the public and then are often arguing with each other about them. And I think I take my work seriously, but I don't want to take myself so seriously that I'm not able to kind of like have a good time and have a sense of humor. And I think the world and just a lot of things happening in life are very bleak. And I think just like making people laugh and taking what we do and positioning it in a different way that's not very relatable and like at best like spicy, but like not ever like offensive or kind of like overboard. I think it's like, it's a way to create conversation and to kind of connect people without like becoming a super opinionated designer that has like one very specific perspective, like, oh, you have to name your layers or your designer should code. Like, my opinions are my opinions, and I don't think, unless people ask for them, they're probably not worth me just like sharing them over and over from a mountaintop, which I think I see a lot of people doing that. And I didn't want to do that, but I also wanted to be part of the conversation, but I just kind of like created my own conversation.
Yeah, that's a really nuanced take on the question. I've thought about it myself some, and I sort of have like, you know, this adverse reaction for whatever reason to like doing the one consistent thing. But to your point, like everyone's going to discover you for something, right? And like, at least you know how they're discovering you. Someone who doesn't sort of stick to, you know, one particular type of thing, you just don't really even know what people or how people think of you or associate you with you, like what they associate you with and things like this. And I feel like there's a lot of value in and of itself of at least knowing like, this is what people expect from me. If I want to change what I'm doing, I totally have the freedom to do so. It's like, you know, a musician goes from doing like rock and roll to like more of country or something like this. Like a lot of their fans aren't going to come along for the ride, but they have this like huge pool of fans that they've built with the rock and roll that a portion of them are, you know, going to go along and some won't. And they'll sort of like know exactly why. And I think the insight on sort of like increasing specificity to sort of get people, more people to sort of pay attention on the internet is very accurate. And the resistance to not doing that may just sort of be not very well justified, basically.
Yeah, I think it's also, you know, some people would say it's like cringe, but then there's the whole Nikita conversation where it's like cringe is in. I think it's also, it's not easy to do. It's not easy to like commit to whatever your thing that you're going to do is and do it over and over again. And I don't know. I think it's not by any means a requirement, and it's not something that everyone should do. And I think like you're allowed to cultivate a really broad sense of interest, set of interests, but you will likely not be rewarded for broadcasting those. However, some people, they become known for one very specific thing. They kind of put themselves in this position, and then they have the opportunity to go into other veins and areas of interest, and then people are more interested because of a perceived status, which I actually think is a bit strange, because I'm the same person I was before I started doing this thing. I just have done this body of work, and all of a sudden, you know, people are interested. And I think it's something that it's heavy, right? Because there's a lot of responsibility, and you want to make sure that you don't steer people the wrong way and that you are good to people. And I think I see a lot of people that will build a platform and then take advantage of people. And I never want to be in a position where I do that. I think it's like, I've had the opportunity to do some really interesting work and meet some great people through this, and hopefully made a lot of people like laugh and like spark some joy in people's lives. But I'm also pretty young and hopeful that, you know, I do and contribute other things to the world rather than just some comedy.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's a pretty good place to wrap. And I know we're up on time, but appreciate all the candor through the conversation. And it was really interesting to see these, you know, and hear these other dimensions beyond the tweets. And so it's great talking with you, and really appreciate the time. Besides Twitter, anywhere you want to send people to follow what you're doing and you know, keep in touch?
No, I think that's probably the main place. I'm on most other social channels, so if you're on a different one, feel free to follow there, but be warned that you're going to get basically the same thing. I don't really change the content for different platforms.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. All right, well, thank you again. I really appreciate it, and looking forward to continuing to follow along.
Yeah, thanks, Jake. Have a great rest of your day. We'll see each other on the internet.